POV. It's mid-November 1986. You are a young South Korean man serving your year of compulsory military service. You've been posted to guard the demilitarized zone, the line that has separated North and South since July 27, 1953, leaving both states in what feels like a perpetually frozen war since the armistice was signed, and to this day stands as possibly the longest frozen conflict in history. At this point, it's become clear to a neutral observer that life is better south of the DMZ, but even though you're barely in your 20s, even you can remember when that wasn't necessarily the case. In 1986, both North and South Korea were still dictatorships. The 1987 protests that would finally bring democracy to South Korea are still 8 months from happening. The South's economy has been growing like gangbusters since the 60s, and people there are now far richer than their northern neighbors. But in the 1980s, the North still had one thing the South wanted: stability. Kim Il-sung, the leader of Korea's communist revolutionaries in the 1940s, had been dictator there since the end of the war. South Korea, meanwhile, has had a series of near-constant coups, assassinations, and shaky military dictators for as long as you've been alive. As you are patrolling along the DMZ, you hear something over the North Korean loudspeaker. You normally pay no attention to the loudspeakers, as both sides are constantly streaming propaganda at each other 24/7. Enough time has passed since the armistice that North and South Korea have developed separate accents. But the Korean on the North's loudspeakers is still perfectly intelligible to you. Yet this time, the message is different. The North Korean loudspeakers are stating Kim Il-sung has been assassinated in an internal coup. The defense minister is now taking over. Has the Kim regime finally fallen? The next week or so was one of the strangest events in Cold War history you may not have heard of. What really happened to Kim Il-sung? And was he even the real Kim Il-sung? Or had the first dictator of North Korea been an imposter all along? I'm your host, Tor Parsons. These are my co-hosts, Jollibee the Durian, Husalino the Capybara, and Thimble the Doll. And welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. South Korean Defense Minister Lee Ki-baek stood before the National Assembly on November 17, 1986 to state to South Korea that Kim Il-sung, the long-standing dictator of North Korea, was, quote, almost certain to be dead. He wasn't. There was no coup. Kim Il-sung would keep on ruling until his death in 1994. So what happened? Where did Lee get this information? It started 2 days before that. Let's take this hour by hour and minute by minute. Saturday, November 15th, 10:43 a.m., Japanese military sources alerted South Korea that Kim was assassinated by someone inside the Korean People's Army, and the assassins had fled into China. 11 a.m., General William J. Livesey, commander of the U.S. forces in South Korea, received the same intelligence update. There is no further information for over 24 hours. Sunday, November 16th, 1:35 p.m., North Korean loudspeakers along the DMZ broadcast praises for Kim Il-sung's 40 years of dedication and contributions to North Korea. This on its own isn't too weird, but it takes on a somewhat memorial-sounding tone. In light of the intelligence information, which hasn't been made public yet, officials are listening closely to what North Korea says. 7:15 p.m., North Korean loudspeakers express wishes that Kim Il-sung may be river water flowing away and fallen leaves. 8 p.m. At last, we get a far more specific public announcement from the North. The loudspeakers broadcast in a different location along the DMZ that Great Father Kim Il-sung was shot to death on a train trip. 8:47 p.m., a morning song is simultaneously played on all the DMZ loudspeakers from the west to the east coast of the Korean Peninsula. 8:55 p.m., a eulogy is broadcast that cites Kim Il-sung's lifelong dedication to Korea's liberation from Japanese colonial rule. Solemn songs, music, and increasingly florid eulogies continue to play all night at different areas along the DMZ. Monday, November 17th, 6 a.m. Loudspeakers announce that while Kim has died, the North Korean Communist Workers' Party cannot fall apart because of his death. If this was a coup, it doesn't seem to have led to regime change. 7 a.m. Another broadcast states there will be an official announcement on Kim's death. 1 p.m. A portrait of Kim Il-sung in the northern sector of the DMZ was decorated with white flowers, a traditional symbol of death. That day, the Chosun Ilbo, South Korea's main newspaper of record, released the now infamous headline, Kim Il-sung Shot Dead. This caused widespread panic and euphoria throughout South Korea. That death announcement was repeated Monday and Tuesday morning on the border loudspeakers. One broadcast was later stated to have said that North Korean Defense Minister Oh Jin-woo was in full control of the country, and all the North Korean people were backing him. To add further confusion, there was no confirmation of Kim Il-sung's death from regular North Korea radio broadcasts. The loudspeakers along the DMZ were used for propaganda messages. There was no history of North Korea switching tactics and using them to disclose important information. So, from the moment the loudspeakers began eulogizing Kim Il-sung, some in the intelligence community suspected this might be a psyop. But to what end? Other than the Chosun Ilbo, the media reported on the rumored assassination with a healthy amount of skepticism. French newspaper Le Monde reported that on Saturday morning, November 15th, the Japanese Minister of Foreign Affairs was informed of the sudden death of Kim Il-sung by a South Korean diplomat stationed in Tokyo and by members of Japanese intelligence in the Japanese embassy in Beijing. Newsweek reported that a Japanese security officer who was returning to Tokyo from Beijing said that in early October 1986, there was a failed coup attempt against Kim, and the plotters fled to China. This was strengthened in the Le Monde reporting that noted that there was a rise in military officers who opposed the rise of Kim Jong-il, Kim Il-sung's son who he was grooming to succeed him, and those officers had taken asylum in China for some 3 years. The U.S. Embassy in Beijing said they had unconfirmed reports of Kim's death that had circulated the capital on Sunday, but they could not confirm whether it was true or not. They also noted that North Korean radio and television broadcasts over the weekend showed no apparent deviation in their regular broadcasting. A State Department spokesperson Sunday evening said the U.S. government had nothing on the matter and will not be reacting until tomorrow. The South Korean defense minister issued an uncertain statement where he said South Korea's armed forces were at the ready if they were needed, but for now they were still watching the developing situation. This is the same guy who, just a day later, would tell the National Assembly that Kim Il-sung was almost certain to be dead. South Korean police began mobilizing their entire national police force as they were put on full alert. This was done to ensure that they could, quote, block possible subversive attempts by impure elements. A South Korean spokesperson noted that there was an accompanying alert on the part of the South Korean military. A Western diplomat traveling north of Seoul on Sunday afternoon reported seeing columns of combat-ready troops pouring northwards toward the DMZ. The South Korean Prime Minister, Lo Shin-yong, called for more vigilance, and South Korean embassies abroad were ordered to step up surveillance of North Korean diplomatic missions. There was a genuine chance that if someone other than Kim had taken power up north, they would invade and the war would resume, or so some in the South claimed. The Japanese Foreign Ministry, where the rumors first originated, said it still needed to check the reports, but were not able to verify them. Someone had the bright idea of contacting Chongryon, the General Association of Korean Residents in Japan. There are two organizations that claim to represent Japan's Korean minority. Mindan, which is associated with the South Korean government, and Chongryon, which is associated with the North Korean government. They act as the unofficial diplomatic liaison between Japan and North Korea. But not only that, they publish pro-North Korea newspapers in Japan and even run Korean language schools, where the curriculum glorifies the Kim dynasty. Chongryon is also estimated to control one-third of Japan's gray market gambling industry, paying the proceeds back to Daddy Kim. A spokesperson for Chongryon said, "We have not heard of anything. We think the report was an ill-intended plot of the South." Chongryon also stated that the South Korean claims were but a political conspiracy aimed at proclaiming martial law and establishing an autocratic system in South Korea. With the mass mobilization of troops on the south side, this was not a crazy thing to suggest. Within Tokyo, the rumors spread that Kim was assassinated by a group of disenchanted military men. One Seoul newspaper report echoed the French reporting, saying that Kim was the target of an assassination attempt in early October and the assassins fled to China, and that Pyongyang was spreading rumors of his assassination to cajole the Chinese government to extradite those involved. The North Korean embassies in Beijing and New Delhi issued their denials of the death reports. The embassy in Beijing said the report was a total fabrication. The embassy in Delhi said, "In my opinion, these reports are not true and are actually South Korean propaganda." Stranger still, a spokesperson for the United States forces in South Korea said that they had no independent confirmation that the DPRK had even made any announcements of Kim's death over the DMZ loudspeakers, while a high-level military source said the Pentagon had received reports of Mr. Kim's death. There was no special alert ordered for American forces in the region. South Korean Brigadier General Lee Hung-sik claimed he was informed of Kim Il-sung's death by General Livesey, commander of U.S. forces in South Korea, and by the CIA, who he quotes as saying Kim was almost certainly dead. My co-writer, Nick Miller, has access to declassified CIA files that the public can't access, and he says no internal documents of the CIA he's ever been able to find corroborated that assessment. General Lee was very certain a serious power struggle was going on. William Horsley, an American spokesman for both U.S. and South Korean forces, said there were no unusual broadcasts. The United Nations Command spokesperson denied claims that North Korean flags were seen flying at half-mast and said that UN soldiers had not heard any such broadcasts. So, wait, not only did it seem like everyone with real ties to North Korea was denying Kim Il-sung was dead, there was uncertainty over whether the North Korean loudspeakers at the DMZ were claiming he died. Seems like it would be easy to verify the claims that the loudspeakers were blasting eulogies for Kim Il-sung all day and all night, especially with the US, UN, and other Western countries' troops constantly patrolling the border. And yet it wasn't. Everyone now agrees that Kim Il-sung didn't really die that weekend, and if there ever were any rumblings of a coup, it didn't get to the point where the coup was executed. But to this day, there are wildly conflicting, specific, well-sourced claims from different Western allied countries either confirming or denying the existence of broadcasts at the DMZ about Kim's death. I think there initially really were some explicit claims on the loudspeakers that Kim had died. I think the chronology of broadcasts earlier in this episode is well corroborated enough that all those broadcasts really happened. But some of the purported things said over the DPRK loudspeakers were almost definitely either willfully misinterpreted or completely made up by South Korea, as we'll see in a bit. William Horsley, noting frustration with the South Korean press, said that the largely government-controlled press in South Korea has meanwhile been allowed to print several elaborate accounts of the supposed assassination. This included numerous extra editions of banners proclaiming the death of Kim Il-sung. This included the following speculations as to how Kim died. Number one, shot at his residence after getting out of his car upon returning from an outing. Number two, shot to death while on a train journey as part of a coup d'etat by the Army Chief of Staff, General Oh Kuk-ryul. Number three, assassinated by a group of military officers who opposed Kim Il-sung's succession plans. And four, deposed in a coup by Minister of Defense Oh Jin-woo. To add further complications, other unnamed intelligence sources said Kim Il-sung had a fatal car accident. South Korean press also stated that the heir apparent Kim Jong-il was being confined in North Korea by the leaders, but this was then contradicted by reports that the DMZ loudspeakers were now declaring Kim Jong-il the great leader. Despite the unconfirmed rumors of the assassination of Kim Il-sung, it was apparently a totally normal day in Pyongyang that weekend. An Eastern European source told the LA Times that in Beijing, he had spoken with his nation's embassy in Pyongyang, and they reported nothing is out of order and everything is going on as usual. Ambassadors from Austria and Finland state that their embassies in Pyongyang said they had no information of Kim's death or any attempted coup. The conflicting reports were taken, at least by the LA Times, to mean that what was occurring inside North Korea was an intense power struggle between rival factions, one trying to disseminate the assassination and the other suppressing it. Another issue at the time was that Kim Il-sung, at the Sixth Party Congress in 1980, had anointed his son, Kim Jong-il, as his successor. This would have been the first hereditary succession in a communist country. This naturally goes against Marxist-Leninist dogma and socialist ideals. At the time, other communist nations were against this succession arrangement. The East German leader, Erich Honecker, during his visit to Pyongyang in October 1986, omitted any or all mentions of Kim Jong-il at his banquet toast to Kim Il-sung. However, hours after Chosun Ilbo released the newspaper stating Kim Il-sung was dead, Kim appeared at Pyongyang Airport to greet the Mongolian president, Yambin Batmonk. This is a tangent, but every now and then I'll come across a country where I wasn't previously aware people have such fantastic names. Thai, Indonesian, and Zulu names are my favorites for sheer length and musicality. I'm now adding Mongolia to my list of countries with personal names that go hard. Batmonk. Hell yeah. But anyway, it was quite clear. Kim Il-sung was very much alive. UIP reported that an Australian trade representative who was at the airport ceremony said Kim Il-sung was healthy. North Korean press said Mr. Kim was warmly met by the Mongolian delegation and thousands of people were at hand to greet both. How did South Korea read everything so wrong? South Korean Brigadier General Lee Hung-sik said in his original announcement earlier that perhaps what they were experiencing was a highly sophisticated psychological operation to cover up the DPRK's war provocations, which was a constant theme in South Korean propaganda at the time. They really thought they were under constant threat of the North invading and restarting the war. The South Korean government acknowledged reluctantly that the reports of Kim's death were false, but also said the DMZ broadcasts were occurring even into Tuesday the 18th, and that even though Kim appeared at the Pyongyang airport, there was still continuing evidence of a political struggle within North Korea. The South Korean government then released the following transcripts from the DMZ loudspeakers, apparently broadcast on the morning of Tuesday, November 18th, 1986. 6 a.m. It was announced that General Oh Jin-woo has now grasped power. The whole nation of North Korea positively supports him. 8 a.m. A report on an unspecified army unit indicated that a mutiny has taken place, resulting in the deaths of 29 persons. 8:45 a.m., a loudspeaker announcer declared, "Do not be deceived by groundless rumors that our leader Kim Il-sung is dead." 10:04 a.m., somber music was heard from loudspeakers and a voice announced, "A big star of the nation has fallen. Let's glorify the great achievements made by him." Never let them know your next move, I guess. What damaged the South Korean government's credibility was the fact that the United States asked for tangible evidence of these transcripts, and South Korea refused to even supply tape recordings of the broadcasts. Further adding to the issue was that the International Herald Tribune, an English-language newspaper for American expats abroad, reported that South Korean intelligence sources had told them the information on Mr. Kim was transmitted to military units within North Korea and not received by loudspeaker or public transmissions. Oh yeah, the North Koreans we're listening to go to a different school. You wouldn't know them. Both IHT and Le Monde reported that South Korean intelligence claimed they had information by Monday afternoon that Kim was alive, but did not pass that along to their own country's defense ministry. Washington had always treated the reports with skepticism due to the fact that there was a lack of radio broadcasts or unusual activity within the DPRK. Sources from the State Department told IHT that South Korean military and civilian intelligence authorities were under heavy pressure from the Blue House, meaning the president of South Korea, to produce information about Mr. Kim's reported death based on a U.S. tip. The State Department claimed that lone report was from a radio monitoring station that may have misinterpreted a story of the life and death of Kim Il-sung's mother as a report that Kim had died. There were those who then began to distrust the South Korean Defense Ministry transcripts as they were designed to camouflage the real sources for security reasons or just outright fabrications. The South Korean government adamantly refused to give the precise origins of the alleged loudspeaker, citing, "We cannot disclose how military information is gathered." Rather, what this did was destroy the credibility of the South Korean military. Defense Minister Lee refused calls to resign after this fiasco. Within South Korea's tightly controlled semi-democratic legislature, Representative Kim Hoon-kyu from the opposition New Korea Democratic Party announced, "We demand that the entire cabinet step down immediately. The government can in no way evade responsibility for degrading national prestige and creating confusion for the people." The government announcement was not a conclusion made by one man, the defense minister, but the entire cabinet after an emergency meeting. South Korean Defense Minister Lee Ki-baek told the National Assembly Tuesday, repeated his assertions that the DPRK broadcast must have been a, quote, super psychological plot to provoke hostility or check South Korea's intelligence gathering mechanism. Lee also told the Assembly that he would be more careful in the future. Prime Minister Lo Shin-yong attributed the failure to a propaganda defeat and that they had suffered from sinister plots and machinations to disrupt our judgment that had tarnished our international image and estranged the people from the government. Opposition leader Kim Yong-sam accused the South Korean government of blatant and intentionally embarrassing political naivete and wanted Mr. Lo to make a formal apology for impairing national prestige. This was refused by Lo, who said they were just reporting the information that they had available at the time. What did the CIA think at the time? According to Foreign Broadcast Information Services, the DPRK really did claim for a few days that Kim was dead. These are linguists and analysts that translate all the newspapers, radio, and TV for the assigned countries for the CIA analysts. They were skeptical that anything had really happened the whole way through, and urged South Korea not to make any definite pronouncements, but did treat the initial claims that the loudspeakers were booming that Kim was dead as true, with specific South Korean and international sources as witnesses for the broadcasts. The CIA stated that the reports of Kim Il-sung's death were ultimately false, noting that their Okinawa station had sent flash messages via Japanese and Chinese media that denied Kim's death. Foreign Broadcast Information Services cited that the death rumor was more imagined than real, leading to the rumor mill across Seoul and Japan that fed upon itself due to the third-hand reports that were accepted at face value. During this time, Pyongyang radio had not reported on Kim's death, and outside observers did not hear any funeral music during any broadcasts. It was noted that every time the Seoul Bureau of FBIS had convinced one government official that the rumor was false, another rumor about Kim Il-sung's death would resurface and the process would start all over. It was taken in three ways. One, that there was an attempted coup, but Oh Jin-woo was not a conspirator, but rather a target. The coup was unsuccessful, but coup participants by the DMZ were not aware of this and broadcasted their message as was planned. The second theory was that there was a valid coup attempt or potentially a strong challenge within North Korea against the Kim family. This challenge failed and was then used by Kim Il-sung to find those who oppose him. He let the death announcement go out along the DMZ, but not within the country, to ensure the general population wasn't aware of what was going on, but the conspirators would react in ways that gave them away. This isn't too different to Mao's Hundred Flowers campaign, an early 60s effort to supposedly allow open criticism of the Chinese Communist Party, which Mao then used to determine who he would purge in the Cultural Revolution. The last interpretation was that this was a psyop by North Korea aimed at sussing out how South Korea would react towards a leadership change within North Korea. Even today, South Korea blames the U.S. and Japan for the 1986 false death report. Chung Chang-yol, chairman of the North Korea Research Association, continues to hold to the claim that no death reports were even broadcast along the DMZ, stating in 2020 that the rumor was a result of two incorrect reports. A U.S. Army Signal Corps military correspondent misinterpreted a somber song played over the North Korean loudspeakers as a funeral dirge, and a report received by the Japanese Public Security Investigation Agency that claimed Kim Il-sung had been killed and his assassins were fleeing to China. But where did that report come from? Nobody knows. The technical term for the November 1986 Kim Il-sung death scare is a massive clusterfuck, a stinking rat king of inseparable truth and rumors. Alliances be damned, not only did every single country observing the situation have a completely different read on it, every individual agency within the countries had a different read on it. The South Korean Defense Ministry was sure he died and was left with egg on their face. At the same time, the South Korean intelligence services were sure he hadn't, but for some reason couldn't tell the Defense Ministry. The Defense Ministry claimed they were getting their information from the CIA, but the CIA seemed to be confident Kim was still alive. But they did allow that there was something strange going on because they had strong evidence the DMZ loudspeakers had been proclaiming Kim was dead. Meanwhile, America's other main civilian service in South Korea, the State Department, denied even that part and said it was all a huge misunderstanding, nobody in the DPRK ever claimed Kim was dead, and the North Koreans were probably laughing at them. This was while the Cold War was still going on, so North Korea back then had a lot more allies than it does now, but even the other communist bloc countries publicly claimed to be baffled, and the rumors circulated there too. North Korean diplomats and liaison organizations like Chungryon in other countries weren't sure, and some acted like they initially thought it could be true, but they hadn't heard anything about it, which made the case that they really were confused far better than if they'd just issued categorical denials. Everyone has pointed fingers at everyone else for starting the rumor. Ultimately, if there's anything this proves, it's that alliances aren't absolute. Almost all countries do quite a bit of going it alone, and in everything from interpersonal to international relations, communication is key. What do I think happened? I think there is enough evidence that the loudspeakers really were broadcasting messages about Kim's death for a few days. I think at least the first round of reported transcripts from the DMZ is probably real. I think the denials that that was happening occurred out of an abundance of caution in the chaos of the first few days, when nothing could be confirmed. And the diplomatic cables Japan received had to be based on something. I favor the theory that it was like the Hundred Flowers campaign. Someone high-ranking in the DPRK military, most likely involved in securing the DMZ, was planning a coup. The coup was foiled back in October before it could get anywhere. Maybe the conspirators fled to China, as the diplomatic cables suggested. Kim Il-sung was afraid that coup supporters remained in powerful positions in the military, and he had to smoke them out, without letting the rest of the country know what had just happened. But the cooperation of Oh Jin-woo, who the coup plotters expected would take over from Kim, but wasn't a participant in the coup and was still loyal to Kim, he broadcast messages along the DMZ intended for the soldiers on his own side, claiming the coup had succeeded and Oh was in charge now, to see how they would react. If they didn't mourn him, it was purge time. As a bonus, he got to see how South Korea and the Western world would react to news of his death. That's my hypothesis, but the world will most likely never know. Of course, a dogged few still insist that there really was a coup around then, and Kim Il-sung really did die, but it wasn't a coup aimed at regime change, it was an internal struggle for control of the DPRK Workers' Party, so the successful perpetrators just hushed it all up and put a guy who looked like Kim Il-sung in charge for what would end up being Kim's last decade of rule. Unlikely? Yeah, probably. But this wasn't the first time that both the communist and capitalist blocs wondered if the man on the throne in Pyongyang really was the same guy first known as Kim Il-sung. Kim Il-sung made his name as a guerrilla leader in China, fighting against the Japanese in World War II to free Korea and China. However, some claim that the man we know as Kim Il-sung, the founder of North Korea, was not the same person as the guerrilla fighter. Rather, that Kim Il-sung died in World War II. The Soviets needed a person that they could unify the new North Korea around and serve as a mythic figure to build a cult of personality. This then led to the person being chosen to become the Kim Il-sung that we know today and later build the cult of personality of the Kim family. However, is this theory true? What is the evidence? Did the original Kim Il-sung die fighting the Japanese? Here, Nick wants to emphasize that this is what the CIA had from this one source. Do not take it as gospel that this is what the CIA believed, as in my research and poring through declassified archives, the CIA generally believed that there was no false imposter Kim Il-sung, but they were aware of the rumors cropping up time and time again. Nick even heard it while he was in the Air Force in the early 2020s, as some North Korea analysts still believe it to be true. As with anything relating to North Korea, figuring out the truth from fiction is very difficult. Plus, North Korea continues to change their own internal history frequently. According to a 2011 declassified CIA document titled The Identity of Kim Il-sung, this very issue was first discussed in September 1949. At this point, Korea had been divided 4 years ago when the victorious Soviets and Americans freed the peninsula from Japanese rule. Like in Germany, the Americans installed a pro-capitalist government in their half, and the Soviets installed a pro-communist government in their half, but the situation was meant to be temporary. In 1949, Kim Il-sung had just taken power in the north, and was a year out from invading the south and starting the Korean War. Kim was born under the name Kim Sung-ju. He had been living in Manchuria, northeastern China, attending a Chinese high school since he was 14. Apparently, while at high school, he killed one of his classmates as he needed money. Fearing being caught, he fled to Longjing, a majority ethnically Korean city in the province of Jilin, considered the heart of Korean culture in China, and then from there to the Soviet Union, where he met a man named Choi, who took him back over the Chinese border to Harbin, who Kim then killed again for money. Harbin, the largest city in China's far northeast, has long been home to a substantial Russian community, and due to its cultural and physical proximity to Russia, it was the first city in China to set up a communist government during China's 1910s warlord era, right after the Soviets had their communist revolution. Then Japan invaded, and at the time the young Kim Il-sung arrived there, Harbin was the capital of Manchukuo, the Japanese puppet state in northeast China, and the site of some of Japan's worst war crimes. The communists led the resistance against Japan. There, in Harbin, Kim met the, quote, notorious Chinese communist, Li Lisan, who was on the run from Chiang Kai-shek's military. Kim Sung-ju, then 18, then joined the Chinese Communist Youth Group, where he was seen as extremely reliable in executing drastic measures. Kim didn't need any further reasons to hate the Japanese. He was Korean, so he'd been born hating them. Japan had gradually drawn Korea into its sphere of influence over the course of the late 19th century and finally officially annexed Korea in 1910. Koreans were treated as second-class citizens. The young Kim Sung-ju revered an anti-Japanese resistance leader named Kim Kyung-chon, who went by the nom de guerre General Kim Il-sung, meaning Kim before the sun. Kim Kyung-chon was a graduate of the Japanese Military Academy and in 1919 began fighting the Japanese with a headquarters near Mount Paektu on the Chinese-Korean border. Mount Paektu is a holy mountain thought of within Korean mythology as the spiritual origin of the Korean people, referenced today in both the North Korean national anthem and the South Korean one, even though it's a long way from South Korea. Today, North Korea's official biography of the Kim dynasty holds that Kim Il-sung's wife gave birth to their son Kim Jong-il, who himself, of course, later ruled North Korea, on the slopes of Mount Paektu. In the West, this is seen as a quasi-religious founding myth, promoting Kim Jong-il as a divine being. And the way it's told in today's North Korea, it definitely takes on that vibe, and it is probably a myth. When Kim Jong-il was born in 1941, Kim Sung-ju, the future Kim Il-sung, was living in Khabarovsk, Russia, and that's usually cited as Kim Jong-il's real birthplace. But regardless of the area's religious significance, it seems that Kim Il-sung wants people to believe that in 1941 he was fighting the Japanese in the vicinity of Mount Paektu, just like another man by the same name, who he might have deliberately wanted people to believe was him. The original Kim Il-sung was known as a brilliant strategist who then suddenly disappeared. Now Kim Sung-ju changed his name to Kim Il-sung and began to operate within the Paektu mountain regions, where the real General Kim Il-sung used to operate. Kim Sung-ju / Kim Il-sung's slogan was, "This is a fight for the laboring masses," although at this point he wasn't well-read in communist doctrine and was just using communist-sounding symbols and slogans because it helped get the working class on his side. He extended his operations to the Jiandao region, the border region along the banks of the Tumen River between China and what is now North Korea. His campaigns were seen as brutal and inhuman. By 1938, he was made commander of the Second Army of the Chinese Communist Force to fight the Japanese in Manchuria, and by 1940, was a high-ranking official within the CCP. According to these 1949 CIA files, which again are probably attempting to portray him in as negative a light as possible, but considering what he later did, who knows, Kim was known for brutality even among his Chinese comrades, which caused all but five of his followers to leave him. This was when Stalin heard of Kim Sung-ju, and in 1940, when Kim was forced to once again flee into Russia, Stalin invited Kim to the Far East Department of the Red Army headquarters in Khabarovsk, Russia, and began getting instruction under the supervision of Shtikov, chief of the Korean section, and later chief of the Soviet occupation army in Pyongyang. Shtikov's job was to teach Kim Soviet history and Leninism-Stalinism, but also maneuver him into a strategic position within post-war Korean politics and convert Kim Sung-ju into Kim Il-sung in 3 years. Kim was described by this early CIA report as neither brilliant nor adequately educated, but proved himself to Stalin as highly acceptable. With the Japanese surrender in 1945, this gave Stalin the golden opportunity for him and Kim to communize Korea. Stalin ordered Kim Sung-ju to assume the identity of the disappeared General Kim Il-sung and appointed him as Secretary General of the North Korean Communist Party. His specific instructions were that no questions should be raised about Kim's identity. Kim must be accepted by all Korean communists as the famous and patriotic general who for years fought the Japanese from the Paektu Mountains. That's the CIA's story. How much truth is there to this? Fyodor Tartisky, a noted Russian-North Korean scholar out of Seoul's Kukmin University, traces the origin this way. There are some elements of this myth that we know are true. Kim Il-sung's birth name was Kim Song-ju. Kim Il-sung seems to have been a common alias among anti-Japanese activists in Korea. Not only did the future dictator of North Korea and the resistance fighter who the CIA mentioned both go by Kim Il-sung, they probably weren't the only two Kim Il-sungs involved in Korea's wars of liberation and division. The first reports of one Kim Il-sung surfaced even before Japan formally annexed Korea. He was born in 1888, and this could have been his original birth name. He was born in Tanchon County, Korea, and was named by the Japanese government in 1905 as a prominent partisan commander fighting Japanese rule. He fought along the Chinese-Korean border in the mountains, including by Mount Paektu, and died in 1926. The second was a man originally named Kim Ponghwan. He was a graduate of the Japanese Imperial Army's Academy. He was a committed communist who may have been the assassin of Kim Chua-jin, a famous far-right activist at the time. He was active between late 1910 and early 1920s before moving to the Soviet Union and dying in one of Stalin's gulags. The third was a man originally known as Kim Hyun-chung. In addition to Kim Il-sung, he used the aliases of Kim Kwang-soo and Kim Kyung-chun, which was mistakenly believed to be his birth name by the CIA. His father was the equivalent of a lieutenant colonel in the Korean Imperial Army, and his brother was a graduate of the Military Academy of the Imperial Army of Japan. Kim Hyun-chung also went through the Imperial Army Academy and served in the cavalry, though the Japanese claimed that he only joined the military to, quote, learn the secrets of the Imperial Army and use it towards assisting Korean independence. But there is apparently no evidence of this, according to Tartisky, and in 1919 he fled to Russia during the Russian Civil War. He joined the Bolsheviks. By 1937, the Soviets deported him to Central Asia, and he worked as a farmer before he was arrested by Stalin's secret police and died in a Soviet gulag. This is the man who the CIA believes the famous Kim Il-sung took his name from. According to the Russian State Archives, the man then known as Kim Song-ju, his original name is something everyone agrees on, emigrated to Manchuria as a child. He joined the Chinese Communist Party in 1932 with the East Manchurian Special Committee of the CCP. He then joined the Army of National Salvation of the Chinese people during the period of the Second United Front and worked under the propagandist Wang Dulin. Kim Song-ju and all communists were later expelled from the army under the orders of Chiang Kai-shek. Throughout the 1930s, he then joined the movement against the Japanese, serving various leadership roles within the CCP's United Anti-Japanese Army of the Northeast. One of the few Soviet records that explain why Kim Song-ju changed his name to Kim Il-sung came from Grigory Meckler, a lieutenant colonel of the Soviet Army, who both knew Kim personally and oversaw his rise to power during the Soviet military rule of North Korea. Meckler says Kim demonstrated, quote, maturity in thinking, in assessing events, etc., and that he, quote, seemed demanding, attentive, respected, and even loved among the fighters. Kirill Meretskov, marshal of the Soviet Union, told Meckler that with regards to Kim Il-sung, he was to, quote, take care of this man. For the first time in many years of absence, he will have to return to North Korea. Almost no one knows him there, and he knows few people. Travel with him to all the corners of the country. Introduce him to the people. This will be good for both of you. When Kim Il-sung was brought to North Korea by the Soviets, he was hailed by the communists there as, quote, the legendary hero of the Korean people, a fighter for the freedom and independence of Korea. Meckler also countered claims in the South Korean media that Kim Il-sung was, quote, invented by the Russians. He was not a real Korean, but a false Kim Il-sung. Meckler shot back, saying, he himself told me that, following the example of his comrade in arms, he took this surname as his own, in memory of his deceased, beloved, and respected commander of a partisan unit. This interview occurred in the 1990s, decades after the events, and when Russians could speak more freely about their experiences. Tartisky notes that Meckler, quote, mixed up a few details. Kim also lied about his past to Meckler. Meckler remembered being told by Kim that his parents were killed because Kim had become an anti-Japanese partisan, but there's no evidence to support that claim. Either way, though, this doesn't conflict very much with the CIA story. Kim was groomed by the Soviets to be put on the throne of North Korea, and he renamed himself after a respected anti-Japanese partisan leader, but Meckler forcefully denies claims that the Soviets literally tried to pass Kim off as the same person. The North Koreans, of course, do not accept the claim that there were multiple fighters under the name Kim Il-sung. They say Kim Il-sung is the only person who's ever gone by that name, and he was born with that name, too. In North Korea's official biography, they say his pseudonym was once written with different Chinese characters, Kim One Star, which was later changed to Kim Becoming the Sun, both of which are pronounced Kim Il-sung. They have him single-handedly creating something called the Korean People's Revolutionary Army and kicking out the Japanese, but not even North Korea tries to tie him to the mythology of previous partisan fighters who went by Kim Il-sung. This then leads to the question, when did Kim Song-ju become Kim Il-sung? Regardless of why, when did Kim Il-sung change his name to what it became today? According to the state-approved narrative of Kim Il-sung, they claim this occurred in 1931. A 1929 document from the Japanese Consular General mentions the arrest of a UN middle school student named Kim Song-ye. This is seen as a misspelling of Kim Song-ju. This showed that by 1929, Kim Song-ju was still known as Kim Song-ju. The first available document to refer to Kim Song-ju by his alias Kim Il-sung is referenced in a 1935 message by Chinese communist Wei Jungmin, which mentions Kim, quote, has much experience in guerrilla warfare and was, quote, the secretary of a large partisan detachment. At least, this seems to be our Kim Il-sung. If this source is correct, and Kim Song-ju did initially call himself Kim One Star, Tartiski believes that the real inspiration for this name change was due to Kim Ponghwan, the second person to use the Kim Il-sung pseudonym, as he was the only person to grow to prominence in the 1920s and died in 1930. It is possible that Kim Song-ju was aware that Kim Il-sung was a semi-legendary name within partisan fighters and changed his name to better fit the image he wanted to build. There are no records to show that Kim Ponghwan was ever Kim Song-ju's superior or ever met him. Kim Song-ju could also have been inspired by the, quote, original Kim Il-sung, the partisan commander who died in 1926, and this is corroborated by the testimony of Lee Yong-sang, who knew Kim Song-ju's brother, Kim Yong-ju. Lee was told that Kim Song-ju loved the stories of Commander Kim Il-sung, and that inspired his choice of a new moniker. Some researchers, especially in South Korea, have asserted that the original Commander Kim Il-sung was entirely fictional, sort of a Ghost of Kiev-style folk hero, and that's possible. No coherent life story has ever been sketched for him. Ultimately, while this is interesting for people trying to trace Kim Il-sung's background, all serious sources agree on a few things. The Kim Il-sung who became the dictator of North Korea really was involved in the anti-Japanese struggle, if not in Korea, at least in Manchuria. He was, to some extent, groomed by the Soviets to become the leader of post-war North Korea. There were possibly real, possibly legendary Korean resistance figures who went by Kim Il-sung before the famous one. It's possible that some attempts were made at some point to convince people that the dictator Kim Il-sung was the same person as a previous partisan fighter named Kim Il-sung. But this was never widely believed or part of official doctrine, and it doesn't necessarily mean that Kim was a manufactured puppet ruler. But in the beginning, he also wasn't clearly not a manufactured puppet ruler. And while sources don't agree on when or why, we know the person later known as Kim Il-sung was not born with that name, and he adopted it as a nom de guerre. Which is not a secret everywhere outside North Korea, and not rare, especially for communist fighters turned dictators. Stalin's birth name was Joseph Djugashvili, and he adopted the name Stalin, roughly meaning Man of Steel, in his 30s as a pseudonym for the pamphlets he wrote. The Yugoslav leader Josip Broz Tito took on the name Tito, which doesn't mean anything, at about the same age for the same reason. I have an alternate history episode planned eventually where I'll talk about a world where Russia never sold Alaska, so during the Russian Civil War, Alaska became Russia's Taiwan, where the losing Tsarists fled to. In that fictional story, a Tsarist general finds an orphaned young woman who he tries to claim is the real Anastasia Romanov and puts her on the throne as the supposed last descendant of the Romanovs. Like the Disney movie Anastasia, except without the twist that she's actually the real Anastasia. Some people, especially on the South Korean right, have tried to make the claim that Kim Il-sung's real-life story is like that. The narrative being, Koreans already all knew about this beloved anti-Japanese guerrilla leader named Kim Il-sung. He died or disappeared sometime before World War II broke out, and after the war, the Soviets plucked some midwit guy who'd never fought the Japanese in his life out of obscurity to rule North Korea and claimed he was one and the same Kim Il-sung. But that's not the truth. There are loose ends in Kim Il-sung's past, sure, but first of all, he really was involved in fighting the Japanese, and second, I don't think the tales of other resistance figures named Kim Il-sung were ever widely known. It's possible that later in his life, Kim Il-sung used body doubles for some public appearances, like many a paranoid world leader, but this explains nothing about his 1986 death hoax, and none of this strikes me as a scandalous rug pull that changes everything we thought we knew about Kim Il-sung. There is no grand conspiracy about Kim Il-sung being swapped out for someone else. All we have are a few other guys named Kim Il-sung who may or may not have existed, and even if they did, Dear Leader never claimed those people were him. North Korea is such an information black hole. The Hermit Kingdom is so sealed off from the outside world and so often genuinely crazy that you can get people to believe basically anything about it. No, they did not claim to have discovered real unicorns. That was a willful misinterpretation of a real archaeological discovery North Korea announced. No, they never told their citizens that their soccer team had won the World Cup. That was a prank by a Brazilian guy. There's a Wang video about how this Brazilian prankster fooled the world. This kind of nonsense is good for North Korea, actually. If you're that secluded from the outside world, and nobody can reasonably call you up to check your sources, you want people spreading outrageous rumors about you. One of my favorite quotes of all time is this line by Voltaire. I have only ever made one prayer, a very short one. O Lord, make my enemies ridiculous. And God granted it. And North Korea is, without a doubt, ridiculous, but there are countries where the government is just as ridiculous. Countries you can visit to see how ridiculous they are. Like Turkmenistan, where, for example, black cars are banned from the capital city and the dictator once changed the word for bread to his mother's name. You've doubtlessly heard things like that about North Korea, and the things you've heard may well be true. By secluding itself, though, North Korea has plausible deniability. North Korea manages to play an Uno reverse card on the claims that they're crazy. They manage to make their own enemies ridiculous. I know people who are convinced everything you hear about North Korea is Western propaganda. They say, well, the Western media printed the unicorn thing as fact, and it's not, so how can you expect to trust them when they say North Korea has prison camps and a cult of personality? They're wrong, but this argument draws a lot of people in. You've probably seen the memes about Yeonmi Park, an American defector from North Korea who has tried to position herself as the face of North Korean defectors, with some success. Can you name another North Korean defector you know? Park has gone on Joe Rogan and made highly questionable claims about North Korea, including that you get executed for watching foreign movies, that North Korea has no word for romantic love, nor even the cultural concept of it, just love for Dear Leader, and my favorite, that the rail system consists of a single train car that people have to push, but they don't have any reason to push it because the rail system only has one station. Park's own past is shifting and indistinct, and she's made claims that she comes from a rich and politically connected family, even calling herself the Paris Hilton of North Korea. Other times, she said that she was desperately poor and first saw indoor plumbing once she arrived in the West. A lot of people think Yeonmi Park completely discredits U.S. reporting about North Korea. She has to be lying, right? Because all the stuff that isn't self-contradictory is nonsense. And all the reporting on North Korea kinda sounds like this. So people think that Yeonmi Park is a psyop, that she's spreading ridiculous atrocity propaganda about North Korea on the part of the U.S. government. But I don't think so, because what she says is such nonsense. Say what you want about the CIA, they are at least smart people. Their efforts are usually a little less transparently fake than this. I don't want to be seen as countering one conspiracy theory with another conspiracy theory, and I warn you, the implication of what I'm about to say is unlikely to be completely true. I just want you to keep all of these things in mind. If people think Yeonmi Park is secretly supported by the U.S. government, she doesn't seem to be helping the U.S. government. What country is she helping? Well, if I was in charge of a country that was so crazy and so hermetically sealed that people outside would believe basically anything about it, and I'd committed genuine atrocities that were relatively well known in the outside world, I think I'd send someone out into the world to test just how much propaganda about my country people would believe. I'd send someone out who tells lies, absurd, hilarious lies, that sound similar to true things people have already heard about my country. If people come out of the woodwork to call her a liar, all the better, because they're implicitly calling everyone else talking about my country a liar, too. You can go on YouTube right now and watch North Korean propaganda videos where travel guides walk around downtown Pyongyang and talk about how great it is to live there. That falls flat. That doesn't feel real because they act like they're trying to prove something. You don't see travel YouTubers walking around Paris talking about how normal it is in an almost argumentative way. And the move-along-nothing-to-see-here approach is a tried-and-tired propaganda tactic. Maybe Dear Leader is getting a little bit more sophisticated in the age of social media. Broke. Paying people to go around talking about how your country is awesome. People see right through that. Woke. Paying people to go around talking about how your country sucks. In such an absurd way, it drags down all the people seriously trying to claim that. I know people who say Yeonmi Park has changed their view of North Korea in a positive direction. People who have heard her claims and wondered, what if it's Yeonmi Park's all the way down? You know? Make my enemies ridiculous. And the story about how Yeonmi Park escaped from North Korea is internally inconsistent and seems to be cribbed from other defector's stories, but she does clearly seem to be from North Korea, because third-party journalists have dug up evidence that she really does have a wealthy and politically connected family back home, so if she didn't go the typical defector route, and it seems like she didn't, how did she get out of North Korea? The most sophisticated propaganda is anti-propaganda. Strawman propaganda, you could call it. The stuff that walks right up to the line of calling itself propaganda, and pats you on the back and congratulates you for seeing through the propaganda. The propaganda that lets you look at the other people who aren't suckered by it and call them the suckers. I've never been too keen on that slogan, "You are not immune to propaganda." Not because it's not true, it is, and it's a worthwhile thing to keep in mind, but I feel like the way it's used, it gets people looking in the wrong direction for propaganda. The way I've seen it used is by left-wingers who are afraid that at any minute some Trumper is going to jump out from behind a tree and pump them full of misinformation. Every culture needs a semi-real but mostly imagined boogeyman to fear to keep them together. In Sleepy Hollow, they told of the Headless Horseman. In Blue America, the mysterious and dangerous enemy who stalks the night is called misinformation. Misinformation, you see, is something peddled by manipulative right-wing grifters who don't believe what they're saying. They're just trying to get your money. They'll tell you crazy things about vaccines and gay frogs and Jewish space lasers, and you should never let them have even a smidgen of airtime or legitimacy because they'll get into your head and you'll believe whatever they say. You may think that you're not that stupid and it'll happen to you, but it can get you too. The other day, a friend of a friend saw the hoofprints of the Headless Horseman, you know. And don't you know that your uncle so-and-so began using Facebook more and more, and wouldn't you know, now he's a full-on QAnon supporter? Maybe you should use something to prevent the right-wing mind virus from getting into your head. Remember, if you don't wear one of these, you'll become a conspiracy theorist. Now, okay. I'm not trying to claim that my uncle went down a Facebook rabbit hole and started believing weird conspiracy shit doesn't happen. It happens all the time. But your uncle who's into QAnon now would be into some other conspiracy theory 20 years earlier. It's not the new technology or the specific political movement that's making him a weirdo. If he's on Facebook now worrying about the deep state, he'd be in John Birch Society meetings in the 60s worrying about the commies. And he'd be on AIM in the 2000s, talking about how Bush did 9/11. Conspiracy theories are native to both the left and the right, and as history charges forward, the side that has more conspiracy theorists goes back and forth. For now, it's the right, same as it was in the 60s. In the 2000s, it was the left, and maybe that'll be true again in the future. You can see this in the trajectory of one man, Joe Rogan. The self-described bimbo populist shoe on head put it perfectly when she said, "We had a left-wing Joe Rogan. His name was Joe Rogan." To this day, I think most of Joe Rogan's beliefs are progressive, same with RFK Jr., another member of that sphere, but having weird conspiracy-adjacent anti-establishment beliefs, no matter what those beliefs are, has gradually shifted into a right-wing thing, as the progressive left has left behind its original working-class base and become a movement of academic elites and socialite socialists. Because working-class people have weird anti-establishment ideas, and that will not change. The default Joe Rogan listener, if he'd been around in 2004, would have voted for John Kerry. In 2000, probably Ralph Nader. That's a culture of people that has pretty much always existed. Joe Rogan is not the hypnotoad. He pulls from an audience that already shares his beliefs. "You are not immune to propaganda" gets used to mean you, fellow leftist, run the risk of being pulled in by conservative and/or mainstream media misinformation, and the only accurate information you can trust comes from our side. But if you are a leftist, you are, by and large, immune to that kind of propaganda. The propaganda you're not immune to are claims like North Korea is actually not that bad. Almost nobody believes everything they hear on the internet, and almost everybody believes everything they hear from people on the internet who they've already decided are on their side. In the earliest days of mass media, the idea behind today's misinformation scare was known as the magic bullet theory. People studying the rise of the Nazis noticed that they were among the first political movements to broadcast propaganda on the radio. And so there arose a notion that people, not you and I, clearly, but most people, literally believe everything they hear on the radio. Have you heard about the War of the Worlds hoax, where Orson Welles broadcast a radio drama about an alien invasion that was so realistic, people across America supposedly panicked, believing Martians really were attacking New York? Well, very few people really believed that broadcast. Which makes sense, right? When we tell this story, we look down on the people who really believed Welles, the same way we look down on the people who supposedly believe online misinformation today. Those sad, poor yokels. You and I can't ever imagine believing something so preposterous just because someone said so into a microphone. Turns out the notion that people believed this radio broadcast was heavily spread by the newspapers of the time because they wanted to discredit their competitor, the radio, as a dangerous new technology. And ironically, the people who ridiculed all the suckers who allegedly believe everything they hear on the radio believed this ridiculous story about Americans who thought little green men were landing because it corroborated their existing beliefs about the danger of radio. This is happening again! I'm not saying social media isn't bad for society. I do think it's bad for society, but in different ways. The misinformation scare, the modern update of the magic bullet theory, is a comfortable fiction that obscures the real ways social media is dividing and polarizing us. The narrative that we need of left-wing Joe Rogan is predicated on the magic bullet theory of media. You just get someone who has the right vibes, get them talking about white fragility instead of vaccine injuries, and all those slack-jawed rubes will believe it just like they believed Yeonmae Park. Right? Because that's how it works, right? With people who are dumber than us, right? The general public, not we enlightened few who know how to recognize propaganda, right? Usually the magic bullet theory of media shows up in right-wing moral panics. Are Teletubbies turning your kid gay? Is D&D turning your kid into a Satanist? Today it's, is Joe Rogan turning your brother into a Trump supporter? You know what the real answer is to those first two, right? If your kid turned out gay, they were already gonna be gay, whether or not they watched Teletubbies. And if your kid is a Satanist, that means they're goth, whether or not they're also into D&D. So if your brother became a Trump supporter, is it because of the media he consumes? Joe Rogan's audience includes a lot of conspiracy theorists is a true statement in the same way a lot of people who drink Iron Brew are Scottish is a true statement. You can then try to claim that Iron Brew makes you Scottish, and people have, but you're mixing up cause and effect. Scottish people drink Iron Brew because people who are already Scottish are in a cultural environment where people like Iron Brew. I included this same photo of this same car in my video last week, the one that was completely fake and deliberate misinformation. I included this just as a meme. Some people didn't realize that Jollibee there in the picture was just added to cover up the license plate and thought it was actually on the car, meaning that this InfoWars watching chemtrail truther either was a Taurus cabinet fan or this was my car. No, although I do want to start selling Jollibee bumper stickers. That would be fun. No, this was just a car that I saw years ago in my hometown in Oregon, and I thought all the conspiracy stickers were funny. I never met its owner. Imagine having a debate with the owner of this car. About chemtrails, say. You would lose, right? I'm sure I would lose, even though I'm also sure that I'm right and chemtrails aren't a thing. Why would we lose? Well, because you and I don't know much about the physics of the upper atmosphere or about how jet engines work. And I'm sure this guy does. I'm sure this guy would send us running to Google to look up stuff about weather and the atmosphere that we would discover is, in fact, true. He isn't misinformed about the atmosphere. He doesn't have bad information that leads him to incorrectly conclude that there are chemtrails. He has correct, factual information that he uses to justify his weird beliefs because he's a conspiracy theorist. If you somehow manage to convince him chemtrails aren't real, he'd move on to another conspiracy that's functionally the same thing. No rise in conspiracy theories due to the internet has ever been detected. Try finding a study concluding that people believe more incorrect things now than ever because of the internet. You believe that's true, right? Now, clearly, you don't believe in incorrect things because of the internet. You don't believe everything online. But the proles, the Epsilon cast, the masses of muttering morons, they believe whatever slop they see on the internet, right? Idiocracy was literally a documentary, right? Now try sourcing your strongly held belief. You believe in science, right? In peer review? Go out and find a peer-reviewed source claiming there's been a rise in conspiratorial thinking. They don't exist. Every investigation into this has concluded that there's always been a percentage of the population given into conspiracy theories. Most people believe one or two things that could be considered a conspiracy theory, and the share of the population who generally believes weird stuff is pretty fixed over time. Oh, there's a misinformation epidemic, is there? Oh, everyone's been suckered by misinformation? You bet they have. Who's misinformed now? You're not smarter than the average person. Even though you're watching Taurus Cabinet of Curiosities. You're not smarter than the average person who you denigrate as a conspiracy theorist or a sucker for Western propaganda either. Because you know who else talks in detail for hours and hours about a wide range of subjects with a camera and a mic and minimal editing for a mostly young male audience? Being into this kind of stuff is more normal than you think. But you think I'm better, right? You think I believe more true stuff than Joe Rogan, right? I think I do too. But you believe that because I'm closer to your political side. Do an audit of me and my sources, and I hope you'll find that I'm more truthful than most online media figures because I value being truthful regardless of the political valence of what I say, but you didn't do that audit yet. You just believe me because you like my vibes. That's how media works, and I'm not sure there's a different way it can work. People do not simply seek out whatever media and believe what it says. You don't do that. And you're not special. People have beliefs that are rooted in their early life experiences, their cultural milieu, and their psychology. Then they seek out media and factual information that corroborates those beliefs. And they worry about getting contaminated with the views of a different belief system, draw a line around that, and call it propaganda. We all live in the DMZ. Everyone's blasting propaganda at each other 24/7. But I think it's edifying that the most plausible explanation of the 1986 Kim Il-sung death hoax is that the death broadcasts were intended for the North Korean side, not the South Korean one. Propaganda usually doesn't change people's minds. It reinforces what they already believe. You are not immune to the propaganda of your own side. Worry about that before you worry about accidentally swallowing the propaganda of your enemy. The less we know about North Korea, the better. For North Korea, that is. Perhaps that's why, for a few days in fall 1986, the DPRK began claiming that their hale and hearty dear leader was dead, to make the reality distortion field between their country and its enemies that much stronger.